Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Bee Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicbee.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. On today's show, I will be hosting a discussion by two respected bee experts about neonicotinoids and global bee losses. But first, I would like to briefly acknowledge today's sponsor, which is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment, and offers over 150,000 titles to choose from. Listeners of the Organic Bee Radio Show can get a free audiobook and a 30-day trial by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/TheOrganicView. Once again, that's www.audibletrial.com/TheOrganicView. Today, joining me will be Mr. Randy Oliver, who is a biologist and owner of scientificbeekeeping.com, and Mr. Walter Hoffaker, president of the European Professional Beekeepers Association and member of the board of directors for the German Professional Beekeepers Association and the coordinator of the Appomondia Working Group on GMOs. So we would first like to welcome to the show Mr. Randy Oliver. Good afternoon,
Hello.
Randy, and welcome to the show. So nice to have you.
Thank you.
And also joining us is Mr. Walter Hoffaker, who is joining us from Germany. So good evening, Walter, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, hello, June. Good to be on the show again.
For the purposes of this discussion, no calls from the audience will be taken. Both experts will be asked the same question and will also be given approximately 3 minutes to respond to the other's answer. So the first question that I would like to ask, and I'll begin with Randy, what do you think about the scientific process in Europe that led to the neonicotinoid partial ban there?
Well, the scientific process in Europe is a little bit different than in the United States. In the United States, what we use is risk management assessment, where you realize that nothing is risk-free. When you get in your car to drive to the grocery store, you have a chance of getting in a wreck and dying. So nothing you do is risk-free. And with the use of any kind of chemical in the environment, there's always going to be a risk because any chemical at a high enough dose is a toxic chemical. Sugar is toxic at a high enough dose. So what they look at is at a cost-benefit risk assessment. On the other hand, in Europe, what you do is they use the precautionary principle. Now, if you take the precautionary principle to the extreme, you would never get into a car because you have a chance of dying from a car accident. So somewhere you have to temper that precautionary principle, and the Europeans decided to employ the precautionary principle. My feeling is it was more of a political decision than a scientific-based decision. The evidence is weak. I doubt if it went to a court of law, it would stand up, the evidence. But it wasn't a court of law. This was an application of the precautionary principle. And Walter can take it from there.
Thank you, Randy. And Walter, what do you think about the scientific process in Europe that led to the neonicotinoid partial ban there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think the scientific process itself is very different from region to region, but certainly Europe is using the precautionary principle as a core way of setting policy. So the scientific process is there to then inform the political decision. And what was interesting about the scientific process in Europe is that, number one, it was initiated by the European Commission after several member states instituted regional bans of neonicotinoids based on the problems that they had seen there. And the Commission simply wanted to know whether there is a scientific basis for these bans. then the process works that not just staff scientists from the regulatory body participate in it, but also the risk managers of the member states, regardless of what their position is on the use of neonicotinoids, were part of the process, and also the manufacturers themselves were heavily involved. And so they were trying to collect all the available data on the impact on these products, not just on honeybees, but also other pollinators. What happened then is that the conclusions coming out of this process gave such a clear indication that there were problems that the approval process didn't pick up on when the products were originally approved, that then the commission, because of the precautionary principle, was forced to come up with a proposal on how to remedy this. And the remedies can range from completely banning the product to partially banning the product, or instituting measures to mitigate risks. The proposal that they then made needed to be approved by a qualified majority of the member states. So it then went into discussion among the member states whether they are the appropriate response to the risk identified by EFSA. And obviously the member states allowed the commission's proposal to go through. And actually a month later, there was a similar process on another insecticide that isn't part of the neonicotinoid group called fipronil. And in that case, the member states were so much in agreement with the approach that the commission took that it got a qualified majority in the first round, which is highly unusual for measures that are designed to protect the environment.
Thank you. Randy, would you like to comment?
No, that's clear. And again, I mean, the point was, it was a political decision, and I don't have a problem with the political decision, but you asked the question, what was the difference? And that's the main difference, is that it was political rather than a political based on some science, but it wasn't a scientific opinion, and not all the member states agreed with it. So that would be the difference.
My response to Randy's response was, at the end of the day, any of these decisions are involving risk are going to be political decisions. That's why we elect the politicians to weigh the cost and benefits of this. But the process that that the ban was based on was not just a little bit of science, but it was almost a science slugout where everybody tried to bring in the best arguments available for either banning it or leaving everything as is. It's just that the arguments for instituting this partial ban carried the day.
Thank you. Question two, should the United States follow the European lead on partially banning neonicotinoids, and why?
To who?
Randy, would you please take the question?
At this point, you're asking the questions, but I would have asked some other questions prior to this, so maybe I should back up a little bit. And here's the thing is, when you look at the scientific evidence, there is a lot of suggestive evidence. But then what I do is, when I look at the suggestive evidence, it's also often kind of scary, I then go out into the field and look at the actual on-the-ground evidence, speak to beekeepers, look at how successful they are in various areas, where they are indeed exposed to these chemicals. And, I mean, when I first, the neonicotinoids first came to my attention. I thought, oh my God, we got to ban these things. I mean, I've been an organic gardener myself for 35 years, and I'm a treatment-free beekeeper. So I'm very much not in the camp of using pesticides in any form. But I'm also a realist, and when I go out to the field and speak to beekeepers who are in areas of heavy neonicotinoid use, they're saying that it's the best it's ever been, you know, with pesticides here in the United States. When I speak to the beekeepers in Australia, it's a similar thing. So what's happening is and I say Australia because Australia doesn't have the varroa mite, the number one problem for bees worldwide. So it's a very good control group to see what the impact is of something without the impact of the varroa mite, which is our number one problem. So the on-the-ground evidence doesn't seem to support some of the claims that the neonicotinoids are the cause of the demise of bees. Now, on the other hand, there are certain uses of the neonicotinoids that are causing serious problems. There was a major kill from planting dust in 2008 in Germany. The problem has been addressed to some extent by modifying the planters. And in the United States, they haven't done that. And the problem was with the EPA, they weren't getting any reports from beekeepers complaining about it. So the EPA representatives came to the national conventions and asked the beekeepers the last few years to please tell them if they're having any adverse effects reports, because without adverse effects reports, as far as the regulatory agency is concerned, nothing is happening. So the beekeepers have started sending those in, and there was an incident in Canada, in Ontario, in 2012, and it's made it very clear, yes, that there's planting dust issues in the United States, and in that case, I would totally support restricting that particular use until they get that technological glitch worked out. Now, as far as a total ban, and the question is, again now, are you asking about honeybees or are you asking about all species? Now, if you're talking about honeybees, I'm not seeing an on-the-ground evidence in the United States that would suggest a complete ban of them. There is, however, some evidence as far as some of the other native species that I would have more concerned about. The good thing that we're seeing is that everybody's on board on this. All the pesticide risk assessment between EFSA, the Canadian PMRA, the U.S. EPA, they're all on board to change in 2014 the way they assess these chemicals, and we'll have much better risk assessment at that point. So, God, now I can't remember what the original question was.
Should the U.S. do
a ban? At this point, I would support a restriction on planting dust unless there's somebody actually compensating the beekeepers when there are these occasional planting dust kills. As far as once the neonicotinoids are in the ground, I don't see evidence supporting that they're a problem. On the field studies I've looked at, they don't support that there's a problem. Now, there are some other issues. Used on citrus, as in Florida, for fear of citrus greening, they're devastating to all pollinators. That there's areas of Florida that are considered toxic to pollinators, and the state actually has a map saying, do not move bees here. Well, as an environmentalist, that's unacceptable to me. So that particular use, I would be very much concerned about for the use with chemigation on watermelons. You can get toxic levels in the pollen. That's been documented. So that would be a particular use I'd restrict. But that's really different than a complete ban on using them. I mean, the reason that the neonicotinoids were developed were as an alternative to the previous classes of pesticides, especially the organophosphates and the organochlorines. The organochlorines, chlordane and DDT and stuff, they've been largely phased out now. The organophosphates have largely been phased out because they're just complete biocides. They get into the environment, they just kill everything. They get in the water, they hurt the fish and everything. The neonicotinoids were developed as a reduced-risk insecticide. They're lower toxicity to mammals, which we are mammals, we humans, lower toxicity to birds, to fish. They're not perfect. Any pest, any insecticide, side means to kill. You know, they're all designed to kill things, okay? You can't get around that. So what you're trying to do is to get something. If you want the farmers to use something else, you got to get something that we're trying to move towards things that are safer. So the neonicotinoids have been considered in the U.S. to be reduced-risk insecticides. And I would say they pretty much lived up to that. It's not perfect, and we're on the learning curve on this, but I think it's a step forward. The problem that we send to the companies that we ask to develop the newer classes, the biocides, the the much more environmentally friendly insecticides is that if they spend millions of dollars to develop a new class of insecticides with everybody's approval on this, and then we just suddenly yank the rug out of them somewhere down the line without going through the a clear legal risk assessment process, that sends a message to them that maybe they shouldn't invest that money in trying to come up with better alternatives to the types of insecticides and other pesticides that we're using right now. And this concerns me. I think the process really should be based upon very, very clear, incontrovertible scientific evidence. And if there's clear problems, then do a partial restriction, but not a total ban.
Thank you. Walter, should the United States follow the European lead on partially banning neonicotinoids, and why?
Yeah, since that was the original question, Randy and I are actually in agreement here that at least a partial ban is called for. And why should the U.S. follow the European lead? I think the scientific process that went on here in Europe wasn't just looking at science conducted in Europe, but was trying to encompass all available science. And in workshops on this issue in EFSA, U.S. and Canadian and scientists from other countries participated in it. So it's not necessary to reinvent the wheel. I think the information that was compiled about these products in this process could very well inform the decision-making process in the U.S. as well. The reason this is just a partial ban is exactly that the scientific evidence was used to strike a balance between the precautionary principle on the one hand and protecting bees and the environment, and the needs of conventional farmers to have some products available. So since the European position was essentially a compromise position between the industry saying everything should be continue to be available as is, and environmental groups asking for a total ban, taking a look at this compromise that was reached in Europe that was accepted by the member states, I think would be a very good idea for the United States.
Thank you. Randy, do you think
Yeah.
independent research should be used to determine neonicotinoid policy?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is right now. That's the main basis of independent research. I mean, the registrant does a small amount of research initially, but then in order to separate them from the research, they subcontract it out to independent researchers, and that research is all studied by the regulators, the EPA and PMRA and EFSA. In addition, then universities also conduct independent research, and if they follow, you know, good scientific methods, that all that research is utilized. When I sit and I talk with PMRA regulators, and I've spoken at great length with the EPA regulators, they're very much aware of this, of all the independent research. And then when you look at their their analyses, the risk analyses, risk assessments of these pesticides, they go over every one of those bits of independent research, and they rate it as to how scientifically valid it was, whether there were deficiencies in that research, whether it's utilizable, and then they decide what they can use out of it. But I can guarantee you, they're very much aware of every bit of independent research, as well as anecdotal evidence. And the anecdotal evidence may not be able to be used strongly in the decision, but it's certainly they're very much aware of it, and it helps to influence their decision. So the EPA, like I said, the EPA at the last national convention for beekeepers in the U.S., they had five representatives there, and we all spoke, and we had dinner at the table with the leading pesticide researchers, independent ones from Penn State University, they spoke with all the beekeepers. They're very much aware of what's happening. So they're as much interested in the beekeeper experience, anecdotal evidence, with independent research. I think it's a misconception that they go strictly by the research conducted by the registrant themselves.
Thank you. And Walter, do you think independent research should be used to determine neonicotinoid policy?
Of course, independent research should be used. When there's a lot of money involved in a product, independent research, truly independent research, sometimes is hard to come by. Anecdotal evidence plays a role as well. Just to recap how this whole everything played out in Europe, we started out with an approval process with required tests that were conducted by the manufacturers, and these required tests essentially said there was an acceptable risk for bees, so the products were approved. Then the beekeepers observed in the field all kinds of problems that were not consistent with what came out of the approval process, and managed to get a few independent scientists involved in confirming what they saw. The first scientists that started to look into the risks of neonicotinoids independently were heavily attacked, and only over time there was kind of safety in numbers, where more and more additional scientists started to confirm this research. The first response by industry was, well, beekeepers may observe things in the field, but what they're observing is not scientifically valid. It's not a controlled study. It's just anecdotal. So the industry asked for repeatable studies in the lab. Then years went by with all these lab studies being conducted, and these lab studies, that's a major reason why Europe eventually opted for this partial ban. The lab studies showed that there were all kinds of effects on bees that the original registration process hasn't picked up on. So now that we have lab confirmation of these effects, the position of industry is, but what about the field relevance? We need field studies now. Well, that is exactly the point where we started. So from the beekeeper's perspective, we feel that we're really getting the runaround here, and we're glad that the regulators in Europe and the Commission and the member states are basically stopped buying into this runaround.
Thank you. Randy, would you like to comment?
Yeah, you know, I hate to put, you know, like some of the judgmental opinions on this. What you realize, you have this, our farmers are going to use insecticides. I mean, I've been involved in the organic farming movement for like 35 years, and in 35 years, we've captured 1% of U.S. farmland. So, I mean, we've been unsuccessful. Now, we can return to this later, how we could be more successful at reducing pesticide use throughout agriculture. But the farmers are going to use something right now. Right now, you know, if you're Joe Farmer and your crop's going to be eaten by insects, you're going to use something. You're going to use, hopefully, something illegal, but you're going to use something. So the question always is well, what do we want them to use? I mean, it's something, there's many of the older are available, other alternative pesticides, insecticides to the neonics, we know are demonstrably harmful. They just you know, kill every insect in the field, and they have huge effects on the birds and other wildlife. So if we yank the neonics, the question always is, will we go back to this? Now, the actual beekeepers in the middle of the U.S. Corn Belt tell me over and over again, Randy, it's the best it's been. We no longer have the kind of pesticide kills that we used to see. We no longer see the dead birds in the field afterwards. So, I'm not a booster for neonics in any way, but my fear is, if they are banned, then what are the farmers going to use in their place? And that's that law of unintended consequences. So you have to be very careful when you do a blanket ban. And this will be interesting for us to see in Europe what's going to happen. Now, the Europeans, beekeepers, hope that the bees are all going to recover and all become healthy when the neonics are no longer used there. From my experience and from me looking at on-the-ground evidence, scientific evidence, I suspect that may not happen. I think I know very well, there's a lot of, as Walter knows, there's a lot of other issues going on with bees these days, especially since the invasion of the varroa mite and of Nosema serrani. So a lot of the things that get blamed on insecticides may not actually be due to insecticides. So yesterday I was out in one of my bee yards, and here was a colony of bees with just dead twitching bees in front of the entrance. When I tipped the hive up on the bottom board, there were about 1,000 dying, twitching bees. And, man, if you got a video camera, it would just look just like a pesticide kill. But I'm in a totally organic area, and it's been snowing up here. So there have been no insecticides sprayed up here all season. And the bees were suffering from an epidemic of chronic paralysis virus, which is a natural bee virus. But if a beekeeper looked at it, they would have probably said, hey, man, that was just a pesticide kill right there. So the question is, you know, beekeepers are always properly diagnosing what the problems are that are happening in their hives. It's very convenient to blame them on one thing or another, but when I actually look at the evidence, I often find that the beekeepers have misdiagnosed what the problem is.
Walter, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah. You know, Randy, the EU-wide ban, we don't know what is going to happen as a consequence, but the EU-wide ban and the whole process, as I mentioned before, was initiated because some member states instituted bans, regional bans, or as early as 2008. Mm-hmm. And what is very interesting is the same claims were made that the farmers will have to switch to other pesticides, that there will not be a recovery of the bee population because there are other issues that mm-hmm. beekeepers are facing with. And in Italy, the government was smart enough to actually institute a scientific process to monitor the results of the ban. And what happened was that, both the numbers for Italy and Germany show that corn production went actually up after the ban. The claims of industry that their products were absolutely essential for the farmers and the production would collapse did not happen at all. And the recovery of the bee population actually happened. So this was actually one of the key factors in the scientific process that EFSA looked at. They looked at what happened in the areas where the partial bans were instituted. And to some extent, with the push for these partial bans, the beekeepers actually saved the farmers money. It is also important to understand that the alternative to using an insecticide is not necessarily using another insecticide. The emphasis that was then put on to respond to the lack of availability of the neonicotinoids was the use of more use of crop rotation and other farming methods. Finally, the the switch to other pesticides, maybe earlier generation pesticides, is also not quite as obviously bad as you suggest, Randy, because the neonicotinoids are used as systemic pesticides, so there the seed is being treated whether there is a pest or not. Mm-hmm. And once you've used the product, it basically is something that the environment has to deal with for the whole year. If you are using spray applications, you can use integrated pest management and take a look at whether the pest is there at all. And for example, if the pest isn't there, not use any pesticide. You can also stick to the regulations for spray applications and spray outside of the foraging times of the bees. So sometimes the spray applications, if they're used as indicated by the approval process, can be better than a seed treatment with neonicotinoids. What you also need to understand is that the theory that they had when they originally approved neonicotinoids was that, well, we know it's acutely toxic to bees if they come in contact with them, but we're using it as a seed treatment and we're burying it in the ground. The problem with that is it turns out that there are all kinds of exposure routes for bees that they didn't think of. The dust problem was only one of these issues. A certain percentage of the seed never makes it into the ground. It ends up in puddles, turning the surface water highly toxic. Again, one of the reasons the EFSA conclusions came out the way they did was a study of surface water in the Netherlands that basically shows a high level of contamination of surface water. They didn't think of gotation in the approval process, and the EU is not just instituting these partial bans, but the EU is in the process of revamping the whole approval process so that the tests to assess the risks properly are more appropriate to the generation of pesticide being tested.
Randy, would you like to respond?
I agree with Walter on almost every point.
All right, good.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent.
I mean, obviously, the seed treatment with neonicotinoids is totally contrary to integrated pest management, that you're
mm-hmm.
putting something on before you ever see a pest. There's also
mm-hmm.
really good evidence in the U.S. that it's unnecessary for
yep.
if the farmers are planting BT, genetically engineered corn, that there's very little benefit in most cases of using a neonicotinoid seed treatment to corn. But this is a different question.
I need
question.
To do a quick response to that later.
Okay. It's
All
a
right.
different question than your question.
Mm-hmm.
One is whether something is actually of benefit to the farmers. That's a business decision. That's an individual decision for them, as opposed to a regulatory decision. So is the regulatory decision to tell farmers how to grow their crop and what business decisions to make, or is it? Are we basing – your original question was on science, so I think we got kind of sidetracked there on whether there's going to be a decrease in corn production. No, I don't think there will be a decrease in corn production. You know, and of course, the industry is going to come back and say that, but that's just part of the game that's played. So – I have to ask you, what are your questions here? If you're asking whether we should follow the European ban, that's one question. Whether you're asking, are neonicotinoids being used to the highest and best use right now? That's an entirely different question. That's pretty much what Walter was going on in there, and in which I'm totally in agreement
mm-hmm.
with him on most of those points. But again, we get down to the bottom line is, if you go to the most intense area of neonicotinoid use in the entire United States, that is the Corn Belt of the United States, where it's in the state of Iowa, 2 out of every 3 square feet of land are planted in either corn or soybeans. Most of those are seed treated with neonicotinoids. And the beekeepers are thriving there. They tell me there's no problem. It's the best it's been. So yes, theoretically, there could be all kinds of problems. In reality-wise, we're just not seeing that. So again, if you say, should there be a ban? Well, should there be a ban if we're not seeing an actual on-the-ground problems? Now, pesticides in general need to be much better regulated. And as Walter said, the new regulations coming in, the new assessment processes are much better. They look at the other exposures, and I'm happy to see them do this. Now, one thing you might want to be aware of is that chemical companies are very much on board with this, and because they, when they're developing something, they only want to have one set of conditions to meet for registration. So if they can have PMRA, EFSA, and EPA all agree on what they want, then it's better for them. And this is something that may surprise some of the listeners, and it surprised me because I've come into contact with lots of people from the industries, and it's really easy to put horns on their heads and to demonize them. But when I actually and you know, I've dealt with salesmen. I would never trust a pesticide salesman. Their job description is to sell pesticides. That's their job. So of course they're going to sell pesticides. So you have to take anything they say with a grain of salt. But when I speak with the scientists who are actually developing the newer classes of pesticides, to a person, these people are concerned about the environment. They have families. They want to do the right thing. They're trying to come up better with more environmentally safe products. And we have to give them credit for that rather than simply demonizing them, because the farming industry is going to call for pesticides for the foreseeable future. And I would love to have a day when we never have to use any kind of synthetic pesticide, but I doubt if I'll live to see that day. So in the interim, we have to live in the real world. And this is the important thing to me is how we work with both the agriculture industry and the chemical industry, and the two of them are very closely related, and how we play fair on this. So when, again, we go back to what's your original question, are we playing fair at the regulatory process, which is a whole different question than saying, are pesticides being used in the best manner? So I would say, no, they're not being used in the best manner at all. Whether the regulatory process is working, I would say, yeah, it is working. It's working kind of slowly, and it could be improved, but my feeling from talking to everybody and seeing everything, it moves. There's a lot of inertia. It's hard to change these things, but it's all going in the right direction. I feel optimistic about the future.
Walter, you said that you had a comment about something
just,
that Randy said?
A minor little fact that everybody should be aware of. BT crops, part of that farming system is actually neonicotinoid seed treatment. There is a joint marketing agreement between Bayer and Monsanto, for example, that requires neonicotinoid seed treatment, because the BT crops, when the plant is small, it doesn't produce enough BT toxin to protect itself. So it's not an either-or, it's part of the overall BT system.
Yeah, I feel that should be changed.
Well, technically, it's the BT system doesn't work without seed treatment. That's the problem. Yeah. All right, on to the next question.
Yes, Randy, what should the registration process for a neonicotinoid consist of?
Exactly where it's going with the new regulation for 2014. They need to look at all the routes of exposure. They need to also test on. Right now, you test on humans, you test on a bird such as quail, you test on a fish such as a rainbow trout, you test on rats for a mammal, and they test on honeybee for insects. Now, they don't test on other bee species. Now, I've read every bit of research, every study, everything that Walter's read. I'm familiar with all of those, and also with research that has not been published yet. We're finding out that different species of insects react differently to the neonicotinoids, and this is going to be a huge thing coming out. So when you ask about honeybees, I can answer for honeybees. But honeybees are not the only concern. There's also bumblebees. There's leafcutter bees. There's the ground-nesting bees. different species react differently to each different pesticide, and we focus tremendously on the neonicotinoids of late to the exclusion of focusing on the impacts of other pesticides. And I think that's a big problem that we're doing right now. There was recently a paper came out from Italy where they found that the herbicide paraquat, that isn't even looked at in pesticide screens, they found that at parts per trillion concentrations, it had effects on the immune system of the honeybee. Well, parts per trillion you can't even measure. You have to dilute it to that. In our single-minded looking at the neonicotinoids, I think that we are probably missing problems that are happening with other pesticides. So I'd like to shift this focus to back to an overall look at re-looking at all pesticide registrations and not just simply focus on the neonicotinoids. And what it does is the focus on one particular thing draws the attention of the environmental community away from the bigger picture, the larger picture. And the larger picture is we need to look at our entire agricultural landscape. our move towards monoculture is devastating to the environment, where the wildlife is having a really hard time. Luckily, and I'm probably going back to your last question, is where we can go. And Walter, I'm sure, and I will probably be in 100% agreement on this. I saw a really good presentation by a guy from Pheasants Forever at a recent bee conference, and he showed all these win-win situations where landowners, hunters, wildlife managers, naturalists, bird watchers all win, and pollinators all win by simply reconfiguring the agricultural landscape away from this massive high herbicide monoculture that we're using right now. His presentation didn't mention neonicotinoids at all, and that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking for a bigger picture than focusing on one little thing, and for us to get away from this distraction and look at that we really need as humans. We're really putting a huge impact on the environment right now, and the agricultural lands are a major part of that. Currently, in many of the agricultural lands, it's hard for a honeybee or for any insect to make a living. They're just disappearing because there's not enough food, because we use every square foot for growing single crops, and we don't allow a single weed to grow there. So now you have square miles that don't have anything for insects to eat, for pollinators to eat, for more than just like the 2 weeks that they bloom. So that would be my two bits right there.
Randy, I just want you to clarify something. In regards to, I appreciate everything that you said, but I just would like you to clarify, in regards to the registration process, do you feel that the tests, as you mentioned, on the different species should take place and it should be the full registration or the full testing process and so on and so forth before registration is granted to a particular chemical, whether it be a neonicotinoid, what have you?
Yes, I do. And up to this point, that just wasn't out there on the table. Now it's coming to the table, and the new processes will incorporate those. Now, it takes a while to make these changes. So, we could change that risk assessment starting with 2014, but it takes years to go through now all the insecticides, for the test to be run on those. So, there's going to be an inertia, and it's going to be frustrating. I mean, I'd love to have it all happen tomorrow, but it's not going to all happen tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Because my concern was with the registration process for clothianidin. From what I understand, it was granted registration, but it, from what I understand, has not necessarily gone through that full process as you described, which really does make sense.
Well, here's the deal. The full process can take a long time, and with the EPA, at least, when they register, they do their risk assessment and they release a pesticide, they're fully aware that there's no way you can predict everything that could possibly go wrong with something. So then you release the pesticide out there and let it be used with the full intent that they're going to monitor it carefully and look for adverse effects reports and for things that they hadn't foreseen. And then what they'll do, if there is adverse effects, if they're serious, they can restrict the registration right then, or they can ask the registrant to do more studies, and they're doing that right now. I mean, I know that Bayer and Syngenta are doing a ton of studies looking at citrus. They're doing studies on corn, on soybeans. for that very reason, because the EPA says, oh, man, we may have overlooked that or we didn't realize that we should be looking at that. So this process is taking place right now.
Thank you. I just think that they should, instead of granting the registration and then monitoring for things that they haven't thought of, they should go through the full process to basically...
But how do you do something that you haven't thought of? How do you design a test for something you've never thought of?
Tell
sure.
you what I'm the Europeans, how they're going about this, you know?
Yes, please.
First of all, I agree with Randy's points that just overly focusing on the neonicotinoids is not going to get us very far. I don't view the neonicotinoids as a distraction, and neither do the regulators in Europe. You know, neonicotinoids have been on the market for a long time. For some applications, they're actually at the end of the life cycle. You have resistance of pests in several states in the U.S. on several crops already. And the business model of the chemical companies actually relies on the products at the end of their life cycle either no longer being effective because of resistance of the pests, or having a ban of the products, because otherwise generic manufacturers can crank out these products cheaply and there's no space in the market for their next patented products. So what is important is that at least the European regulators are looking at the neonicotinoids as a learning experience, where they said, okay, at least in Europe, they were registered based on all the tests that were required at that time, and they're looking at what happened here now as at least a partial failure of the old approval process, and that's why there is a guidance document being proposed right now, where the risk assessment is going to be done differently. And part of this is even obvious in the title, because this risk assessment guidance document talks about honeybees, but also about bumblebees and solitary bees. So because now it is very clear that not just honeybees are a protection goal, but the other pollinators are a protection goal as well, you can decide to conduct certain tests with the species that where you can most easily demonstrate whether there is a problem or not. The honeybees turn out to be a bit of a problem for the scientists trying to design the tests for approval, because honeybee colonies are extremely complex. And it is also very difficult to have a controlled environment. One of the problems that a lot of these studies had is if neonicotinoids are extremely widely used, where are you going to come up with a neonicotinoid-free control for your field experiment? So the other species are going to help streamline the approval process. One thing that came out in a scientific symposium that happened here in Germany, is that a lot of the researchers are running in a situation where if you conduct a short-term experiment, it looks like problems that you can clearly demonstrate are affecting individual bees don't appear to be translating into problems at the colony level, because there the colony is essentially able to buffer. But then, if you run the experiment further, you find that there's a price for this buffering, and there is a point where something that looked like it was completely on track and normally suddenly collapses. And so they're right now in the process of trying to figure out how you can take this information and design tests for the registration process in a way that can be standardized. And at one point where I'm not quite as optimistic as Randy is about where where the overhaul of the registration process is headed, is I've been in many meetings where I was observing how the representatives of the chemical companies deal with this, and essentially. These complexities always provide an excuse to do more research, to delay action, which means that the old flawed registration process remains in place. And where we need to get to is to start instituting some of these tests, even if they're not perfect yet, instead of using this test issue to delay instituting improved tests at all.
Thank you. Randy, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, Walter hit the nail on the head with the registration process. It takes quite a few years for a company to develop and register a chemical. And if it's on patent, then they only have maybe 7 to 10 years to recoup all their investment. So they're under incredible pressure to try to get it out on the market as quickly as possible before it either goes off patent or, as Walter says, before the insects develop resistance to it. And with the incredibly widespread use of some of the neonics, we're going to see resistance develop pretty quickly, and they will have to move on to something else. So that's something that will happen. The other thing, and again, the point was very good, these honeybee colonies have this tremendous buffering capacity. You can feed a honeybee colony very high levels of the tested clothianidin or imidacloprid for very long periods of time, and you just don't see an effect. Now, if you make a smaller colony, the smaller the colony, the more you see the effect. So, are we talking about theory or real life here? So that's what I'm saying. I like to go out on the ground and actually see beekeepers who are keeping their colonies alive year after year after year, and not just keeping them alive, but they're making money on them and they're producing honey with them. So,
an effect.
Yeah.
The thing is, what the researchers concluded is, a lot of the studies that don't see effect are simply too short because you're essentially in the buffering phase of the colony. But at some point, you're running out of buffer, and then you have a rapid collapse.
And this is what I'm saying. With the beekeepers who are keeping bees year after year after year after year, there would be no running out of buffer. These guys are doing it. They're living in it. They're living in it year after year, and they're not seeing this happen in real life. So when you talk about lab studies, it's one thing. When you talk about real life studies, and this has been the thing that, you know, I follow all the science, but I also get my feet out on the ground and go out and visit beekeepers and look at what's actually happening in the real world. And I have to weigh those two. I mean, what I see with my own eyes. If that does not support what the science is saying might happen, then I'm saying, well, God, it looks like maybe it's not happening.
Randy, I think you have it slightly backwards because the science, the new round of research, happened after the beekeepers observed problems in the field and pointed to the neonicotinoids. We actually had a research project in Austria, where they didn't follow the German lead of the partial ban because industry said, well, we're going to improve the seed treatment, the quality of the coating, we're going to improve the equipment, we're going to install filters and deal with the dust problem. And the Austrian government said, okay, fine, we let you do that, but we are going to monitor whether this actually works. And mm-hmm. so they funded the Melissa project. And what happened was I talked to the chief scientist that was doing the monitoring, and the Melissa project was if a beekeeper saw a problem that he thought was related to pesticides, a group of scientists went out and basically did the complete post-mortem. And he mm-hmm. said in his scientific career he had never seen such a high correlation between beekeepers saying, I think I've got a pesticide problem here, and them being able to confirm that. So the beekeepers, at least that I represent here in Europe, they are up in arms because they are seeing this. Some of them are taking evasive action and are leaving certain areas that they used to produce honey in to protect their bees. But at least the beekeepers that, and you know, I'm a beekeeper myself that that I'm dealing with have quite a different view. And that's why also, you know, beekeeping organizations, there's rivalries, there's, you know, squabbles. I have never seen the beekeeping community so united around a cause because they're all seeing that this is a real issue, not just something that happens in a lab.
Yeah, and in the United States, there are people who are adamantly convinced also, and there's mm-hmm. people who vote Republican, there's people who vote Democrat, and they feel very strongly about that. I just, all I'm telling is what I see with my own eyes. I've mm-hmm. talked to the presidents of the state associations, beekeeper mm-hmm. associations in all the corn states to ask them yep. what they're seeing. I've talked to the local people. I've visited them.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so we have a different experience
yep.
here
I guess
than what you're seeing there. Now and as you say, Walter, it's very, very complicated. There's a lot of stuff happening in beehives these days, and pesticides certainly are a part of that, especially the beekeeper applied pesticides to control the varroa mite. So it's a very complex thing, and I don't think that there are really simple answers on it. As much as I would love to have simple answers, mm-hmm. I caution on that, and it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I agree with that.
3-year restriction in Europe, whether we actually see an improvement in bee health over there. Right now, I can tell you that the beekeepers in the American Corn Belt, if they care for their colonies properly, they don't need an improvement in bee health because the bees mm-hmm. appear to be doing very well there.
Well, it's actually a point that you raised with the beekeeper applied chemicals. this was a point that I made to representatives of the chemical industry because some of them are actually have divisions that are selling products to control the varroa mite, mm-hmm. and I don't think some of these products are it's in their best interest to market them because they actually have synergistic effects with the pesticides they are marketing, and it would be much smarter to go on the varroa side to things like organic acids that have a completely different mode of action and where they're not exacerbating the problem with the varroa sites that they're selling.
I'm in complete agreement with you. I've only used natural treatments for 14 years now in my operation. I run a successful commercial beekeeping operation mm-hmm. with no synthetic miticides. So, yeah, mm-hmm. preaching to the choir to me.
Yeah, well, at least Bayer actually listened. I can send you and all the listeners where maybe June can post it. In the middle of this neonicotinoid battle, I managed to compartmentalize things and work on a research project with them to do the mode of action research on formic acid because that is, I think, you know, I think beekeepers should do whatever they can to keep their bees healthy, and I'll accept support from anybody that is willing to do that. But at the same time, the chemical companies need to take responsibility for the products that they're selling and work on their end of the equation.
I agree. Hey, one thing I'd like to, June, before we end.
Sure.
One of the things I've been asking with the EPA trying to do is to set up sentinel apiaries throughout the agriculture areas of the United States where you put out hives, you have them professionally managed to make sure that they're managed properly to control parasites, and then to see whether they can indeed survive in those agricultural areas. The problem is it falls between everybody's jurisdictions. I've spoken with the head of the U.S. Agriculture Research Service. I spoke with the head risk assessor for EPA. Everybody says, well, that's not in our purview to do that. That would have to be U.S. Geological Service or something. And they're not interested. If somebody right now donated $1 million for bee research, I would use it to set up sentinel apiaries throughout agriculture areas all over the United States and in Europe would be great also. And that would be the final proof. If you can't keep honeybee colonies alive, and I would also put an acre of natural forage in each one of these places so you look at the native species, and that would tell us, that would be the absolute on-the-ground proof. If in an agriculture area, if you set aside an acre of natural area untreated with pesticides and allow the insects to forage in the agricultural area, whether those species can survive there year after year. And if they can, then we're doing a successful agricultural system. If they can't, then that would tell our regulators we are failing at being able to keep the natural wildlife alive in our agricultural systems, and there's something that we need to change. So if I had my dream come true, I would set that up immediately.
Walter, any last comments?
Well, some of these comparative studies that are going in the direction that you mentioned, Randy, have been done, and it basically shows that the best place to keep bees right now is cities because of the diversity of foraging opportunities in parks and trees that line the streets and so forth. And limited pesticide use. So pesticides are only one part of the equation. Intensive agriculture overall creates an environment that is hostile to bees and native pollinators, and we need to work on changing that paradigm.
I am in complete agreement with you.
All right. Okay.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. It has been a pleasure having you on the show today. We are out of time. It has been a very interesting conversation. So thank you both for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
And folks, thank you for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic Bee Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.